We're going to talk to you about the most urgent thing that is on our mind, and what we suspect is the most urgent thing on the minds of those who will connect with us. We'll title this tape, Planet Earth About to Be Recycled. Your only chance to evacuate is to leave with us. Planet Earth About to Be Recycled. Your only chance to survive or evacuate is to leave with us. Now, that's a pretty major statement, pretty bold in terms of religion, in terms of anybody's intelligent thinking. To most people who would consider themselves intelligent beings, they'd say, oh, that's absurd. What's all this doomsday stuff? What's all this prophetic stuff? You know, intelligent human beings should realize that everything has their cycle. They have their season. They have their beginning. They have their end. They have cycles. We're not saying that planet Earth is coming to an end. We're saying that planet Earth is about to be refurbished, spaded under, and have another chance to serve as a garden for another human civilization. Now, the reason this is such an interesting time is not only because we're on the threshold of the end of this civilization, because it's about to be recycled, but because of where that finds us, where that finds you, where that finds those who would judge us, how we would speak of them and how they would speak of us. Now, you keep saying us. Who do you think you are? Well, I, in all honesty, must acknowledge my father. My father is not a human father. My father is a member of the evolutionary level above human, the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven. My father gave me, long before this civilization, gave me birth into that kingdom level above human, that kingdom of heaven, that kingdom of God. Now you can say, well, I can't believe that. Well, it's up to you whether you believe that or not. That's not important to me, even though I wish that you could believe it for your sake. For those who do believe it, stand a possibility of a future beyond this recycling time.
Episode of Emotional Manipulators for Hire. I'm Brett. With me, as always, is Nathan. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, how's it going?
Without further ado, very pleased to be welcoming Landon Porter. Hi, Landon.
What's up, everybody?
Now, Nathan, you introduced this to us as build your own cult for fun and profit. So saying, oh, you're the perfect person to come talk about cults, I don't know. It doesn't sound flattering to me, but here Landon is, and maybe you could explain to him and the rest of us why you thought he was a good guest for this topic.
For people that don't know, Landon Porter used to do the Sales Guerrilla group on Facebook. It has morphed into Dude, It's a Game, And ever since Landon first came into my world years and years ago, it was right when he was starting to first build this. What he did with the what they called the jungle, it was the sales guerrilla, getting sales without being salesy community. He just exploded this group, this Facebook group, faster than any group I'd ever seen. And it wasn't by accident. I noticed a lot of the things that Landon was doing deliberately and intentionally. And Landon, when we've talked about this, he likes to call it culture, which I halfway agree with, but I also, I'm edgy and I like to just say things bluntly. And as far as building a cult following, Landon is probably the expert at it more than almost anybody. I'm going to say actually more than anybody I know. Landon knows how to build a culture, a cult following, and it can be used for marketing, like most things that we talk about on these episodes, but it can also be used for ill intent, for manipulation, for societal purposes. And we always like to do the double-edged sword conversation. And to have anybody on or to just do it ourselves, I didn't think it would be complete without having Landon come on and do it. So with all of that out of the way, Landon, thank you for joining us. And if there's anything that you would like to get out of the way about yourself, as far as listeners maybe not knowing who you are, I'd like to turn it over to you for a second.
The first thing is I sure as hell hope to live up to all the hype. Like, thanks, guys. The second thing is I'm just a dude figuring out my own shit, trying to understand how best to operate myself in this experience. And the next piece that I would say is there's two kinds of people in this world, leaders and those who need led. My entire journey has been to figure out how to lead myself, so I'm not looking to be led by somebody else. And I think most of us, likely knowing you two, most of the people in your crew listening to this, have the same kind of feeling to it. Now, how can we help people that don't have a background in marketing and culture building see it when it's happening so they can avoid it and or use it for their benefit if they do it the right way? Now, I know that wasn't a whole lot about me. I'm a dad. I'm a business owner. I've been a sales guy for more than 20 years. At the end of the day, I think relationships are the most important thing. And if that's the case, the one you have with yourself is the most important. What it takes to have a relationship with yourself is to know yourself so you can understand yourself. So all of the things that we're going to talk about today, I'm sure, can be applied to using on other people, seeing it when it's done to you and other people you know. But more importantly, how do you use these things with yourself so you can get yourself bought in on your own ish so you can really get, be, and do whatever it is you want?
I think you misunderstood. We're not here to take responsibility. We're here to point fingers and blame.
Oh, okay.
I should have sent that over in the show notes. Dang it.
Well, you know what, Nathan, you said in the intro, like we always talk about the double-edged sword, and cults can be used in marketing and for good, or some, I guess, principles of cult building can be used that way. But then you said sometimes cults are bad. Just on behalf of the incredulous people in the audience who maybe had a really positive cult experience that was, you know, particularly transformative, what's an example of a cult not working out?
I think there's lots of examples of cults not working out.
Yeah, a collectivization problem with like labeling cults and then pooling things together that are sort of breakaways or countercultural that sometimes get mislabeled cults.
I'll start off with one that I started falling into. Once I realized kind of what I was falling into, I quickly backpedaled. It was when I first started getting into all of the libertarian philosophy stuff. And I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but this is just my own personal experience, my own lived experience, was the Freedomain radio culture that was built there. Once it started, the concept of defooing and if your friends and family don't understand the principles of anarchism, you just don't talk to them. You just move away from them. You don't have any kind of relationship with them. If they want to use the state against you, they're your enemies and you can't, like, that was to me, I was like, whoa, am I like tiptoeing my feet in the water of a cult? What's going on here? So that was kind of, I guess if I was going to say my own experience, that. And then growing up in a hardcore liberal family, there's a lot of cultism in that as well. But so on both ends of the spectrum, the hardcore, almost right-wing libertarian and the hardcore left-wing identity politics, class warfare politics, both of them early on in my life realized, wow, there's a lot of cult mentality, even in culture, which I think people would say, well, these are just countercultures or these are just parts of mainstream culture. But I think that both of them were heavily cult influenced. But I'm curious as to where you were going with this.
Oh, I was just, yeah, I mean, I had some contact with Free Domain, and I actually knew Stefan Molyneux years and years ago. From what I saw, it really... It'd be hard to call that a cult, but it's very easy to call things cults from the outside, especially if for some reason you develop an antagonistic relationship with something they're promoting or something that they're believing. I could totally see how somebody could look at Free Domain as an outsider and label it a cult. But from my experience with Stefan Molyneux, he just didn't seem like a cult leader to me. Or like wanting to be a cult leader. Now, when I was in high school, somebody did attempt to recruit me into the Heaven's Gate cult.
No.
People who, oh, sure. Yeah, I was 17 years old and we were ditching some class and smoking cigarettes in the woods. And this kid, Andy, had just, you know, he didn't wind up with the sneakers on in the bunk beds, but he was interested. And Heaven's Gate, for people who don't know, this was Marshall Applewhite. And I think the thrust was something was going to happen to the Earth, but a spaceship disguised as a comet was going to go by and you could get on.
The Hale-Bopp Comet.
The Hale-Bopp Comet. Yeah, you could get on. So by participating in this ritual suicide. So this kid, Andy, who, you know, I just used to smoke cigarettes with in the woods. He went to one of their meetings when they came to the town I grew up in, and he was all for it. I was rightfully skeptical, but he wound up not joining, and I wound up not joining. So, dodged a comment.
Landon said culture. He made sure to add that chur to the end of it. Landon, if you wouldn't mind kind of explaining how you differentiate cult and culture, because I think... There's a lot of overlap in that Venn diagram. What is it that separates a cult from a culture, in your opinion?
So as you guys were both talking about what cults have gone bad, it occurred to me that certainly in the show notes for this, but to start with the definition of what a cult is, right? Because words in our language, specifically the English language, many words mean a very specific thing, but collectively our understanding of what one word means is widely varied. My wife for 25 years was like, her whole thing was she wanted to be a cult leader. Until this last year, she started watching some documentaries and stuff about different actual cults. And she's like, that's not what I want to be. Right. So what I consider the difference between a cult and a culture is just that, when you're leading somebody versus commanding somebody, right? Cult is literally, this is what we do, and people in your world that don't get it or don't belong or don't agree with it, you're no longer allowed to associate with those people. If you're going to lead me in something, that's one thing, right? That's leadership, and we can use haha funny terms around it, and we can make it seem cultish or culty, right? But when it gets to the point where you're dictating what somebody can and cannot do, right? The difference between right and wrong is no longer what's right and wrong for humans. It's what's right and wrong based on what I said. Well, who are you to have said that, right? And generally, they think they're Messiah in one form or another. So my distinction between the two is one is something you can participate in and another is something you can't get out of.
So just to muddy the waters a little bit, the term cult classics, like movies like Rocky Horror Picture Show or maybe books that have built a cult following, how does that definition of cult kind of fall into this? Or maybe it's the exemption that makes the rule when it comes to like cult followings or cult classics for a piece of pop culture.
Yeah, it's the idea, and they're leveraging the word for some of its sub uses, like we're going to be talking about today, the insider language, right? What does a cult movie have to be a cult movie? It's an underground thing that only appeals to a certain kind of people, and only a certain kind of people watch it. And when everybody's in on the inside joke or the inside information, they know something that everybody else doesn't. We're aware of something that you're not, ultimately, is what it comes down to. That's the reason for the languaging and the secret handshakes and all of that stuff. It's one of us versus them.
And a building of a kind of camaraderie, too. Like when you talk to people in Billy Madison quotes and you understand each other, right? That brings you closer together. This was actually one of the topics of our university discussions not too long ago. And I had my friend Scott Hambrick from Online Great Books, who has been critical of what he sees as the sort of disappearance of culture in this country, like a distinct American culture. And we talk a lot about city culture versus rural cultures. And I, you know, see those two things juxtaposed against each other almost every day between, you know, the city of Pittsburgh and the rural part of Pennsylvania that I'm in right now, where it's just the difference of 15 miles is absolutely huge. And one of the things that we talked about in that is that cultures are often built slowly and sort of organically through workways, folkways, and foodways. And cults are top down. We also see things like corporate culture. But if you see videos of like corporate team building or corporate pep rallies, they look like cults because they're trying to force it from the top down. All of those people only came together around like needing a job and having a set of skills. And anything else that is trying to bind them together is artificial. So those things will often look like some kind of top down directed like cult ritual. I would say even the idea of an American culture is fairly forced and collectivized because America has countless cultures. You know, I mean, the cultures that I saw just growing up in New England from one place to another, even in close proximity to each other, and how distinct they are from one another. You know, you travel 100 miles and you could be in entirely different cultures. So, you know, there is a kind of a framing problem, too, and a collectivization problem. And that was kind of where I was going with Free Domain Radio. Cult experts, I've heard them estimate as many as like 5,000 active cults currently in the United States. But what do they consider a cult and why? Right. And as cult experts, the go-to people on like pointing out the dangers of cults, there's some self-interest involved there in like labeling more things as cults. And like I said about Free Domain Radio, it's easier to have with an outsider perspective, you know, be liberal with that label of like, oh, that's a cult. And there's also something that I think is worth, as far as framing is concerned, entering into the record as, you know, countercultural movements being maligned as cults. With this ridiculous, like, oh, how could some people be so troubled or lost that they would wish to turn their backs on mainstream society, right? What's wrong with a person who doesn't want to, like, go along to get along in, you know, mainstream America or wherever they are? So it's almost like we've gotten to a point, I think, this is my opinion, where if somebody, and no one is, like, looking to join a cult, looking in the, you know, classified ads or on Craigslist for, like, cults to join, doesn't happen that way. But somebody who winds up in a situation with something that is cult or cult-like, I don't think that's a reason to necessarily label that person as gullible or defective. They're probably looking for something that they couldn't find in mainstream society. In fact, it was Stefan Molyneux who said to me maybe like 10 years ago, he had gone to some Free State Project event. And afterwards, he asked me, he said, what do you think gets people interested in being a part of something like that? He said, do you think it's just like that those people glom on to this liberty movement as a kind of answer or an explanation of why they didn't fit in? He was genuinely curious, like coming from Canada and seeing something that he had never seen before. Like, what do you think is attracting to people like this? Or what self-perceived deficits or weaknesses do you think these people might have or inadequacies they might feel that they get some kind of comfort or assurance or belonging in something like the Free State Project, where all you have to do is profess a set of beliefs and then you belong. And that wasn't top down, so it's hard to call it a cult. There was no leader. There were certainly figures of influence, but it'd be a stretch to call it a cult. But somebody from the outside trying to dismiss it or trying to deride it could label it that. And so I think a lot of things get mislabeled cults as well.
It feels to me like you're trapped inside of a cult and you just are in denial about it. So you're trying to make excuses as to why your cult is not a cult like all the other cults.
Which one? Free Domain Radio or Free State Project or my own stuff, which has also been accused of being a cult. So you got to have to spend. I could be in three. I could be running one.
But I think there's a couple different ways that we could go here.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to do is maybe explore the reasons why people join cults, and then also explore some of the things that cult leaders deliberately employ to exploit those reasons, to exploit maybe parts of the human psyche. And the reason why I want to talk about that is, first and foremost, just to be completely honest, it's a lot easier to get people to make a decision you want them to make when they're not thinking of themselves as an individual, when they're thinking of themselves as part of a group, that a lot of times people look to what the group is doing to inform their decisions. When I'm going through the testimonials on a sales page, I'm going to look for people who are part of my group in order to see what do people who are just like me say about this product or service. If I'm in the middle of something that's going on in the world and I don't know what to do, I'm going to look for people like me and look and see what they're doing. So it's just part of human nature that most of us will look to see what other people like us are doing in a situation to better inform. So getting people to identify, deliberately getting them to identify as part of a group, makes it easier to help direct the way their information steers them. I think that that's probably the most appealing part when it comes to actually starting a cult, or when it comes to starting a cult around your brand. And we'll talk about that later. But before we get into that, what makes some people susceptible to give up their own personal identity and instead identify with a brand or identify with a cult or identify with a group? Nowadays, it seems like that's, I watch all these college kids come out and the only thing they can identify is their group. I'm X, Y, and Z, so therefore this, and this about me, or I'm part of this community, and so I'm going to vote for this particular person, or I'm part of this community, so I'm going to buy this product and support this particular company because they support whatever, or I'm part of this community, so I have to feel this way about some divisive political issue or social issue. Why is it that people are susceptible, some people more so, to giving up their own personal identity, their own power over their own identity, and so quick to join one of these either brand cults or cults and give up their own agency to the group identity?
Self-responsibility is hard. And Brett said something to this effect earlier, that not everybody who joins a cult is stupid. Not everybody who joins a cult can be just walked right off a ledge against their better judgment because they don't have better judgment. I think there is a large percentage of the population, and if we're going to be frank about it, the average IQ is 100. That's average. Self-responsibility is a tough thing. Making decisions, it doesn't take very long to make a bunch of dumb decisions to realize that you don't know what's best for yourself. That's one piece of it. I'm not saying that's all of it. But I think there is something to be said about that. A huge majority of the people that get talked into doing things that are wrong or inappropriate, it's pretty easy to talk them into it. Why is that? They don't have the ability to discern what's right and what's wrong. And it's easier to just be told what to do. That's one aspect of it.
Yeah, I talk a lot on my show about having go-to guys. certain political things. It's like, what does Tom Woods or what does Dave Smith have to say about this? Or if it's like a more philosophical concept, what does Steve Patterson have to say? I built a digital product around bringing these people together, like people who are my go-to guys on different topics. But I like to think that I'm just not outsourcing the entire critical thinking process or examination of something, that I've developed a kind of shortcut based on having a criteria of who is trustworthy and who is acting with integrity. So I don't have a list of 100 go-to guys and gals. It might be like 10 or 12 people. If somebody didn't recognize that, or they didn't kind of open that up and examine, it would be very easy to just wind up following somebody who appears to have all the answers. I mean, my criteria for people being susceptible to this kind of thing, I would say that, you know, number one, this is why I think this is such a timely topic. The first precursor is probably some recognition of instability in the world and some kind of insecurity about that. The second one would probably be personal. It could be financial instability, or it could be some lack of self-confidence. With those two things combined, people tend to look for assurance and belonging in times of confusion and division, which we're certainly in. And that could come from, I don't know, a very clear kind of mode of operating, right? Like identity politics provides, who's the victim? How do I get meaning by doing something to look like I'm helping the victim? So it could become just like a very clear set of operating principles when you see this thing attack this thing. Or it could come, as is often the case with cults, from a charismatic person who appears to have things pretty figured out. And, you know, another reason why this is so timely is with personal branding, influencer marketing, it's never been easier to present yourself this way. You know, I feel like I'm pretty vulnerable on my show. I'm still coming across as a pretty like cleaned up version of myself. But we all know the stories about people who set up these like personal brands and they're renting everything that they're showing you. I forget the guy's name who was always accused of that. But there's a lot of these people. So to present yourself as a charismatic person who has a lot of the answers and has everything figured out and is already succeeding in all kinds of way that you, Instagram or Twitter or Facebook or YouTube user, is not, that's a pretty easy thing to project into the world, whether it's true or not. So in an age of instability where, you know, a lot of people might also be like really financially insecure, there's a lot of people who are kind of vying for that time and attention and loyalty from people out there who, like the people Landon's describing. They might not be stupid, but, you know, life is complicated enough and they really just don't know what to do as far as bettering themselves is concerned.
Yeah, I think the other thing too, or one of the other things Landon kind of touched on, giving people validation and purpose. Everybody kind of wants purpose. Nobody wants to feel, maybe I'm making too much of a blanket statement, but most people want some sort of purpose in their life. They want to know, what's the reason for living? What's the reason that I'm here? I want to feel like my life has purpose. Also validation. I mean, social media is just validation feeding machines. It's, I'm going to complain about these people because I'm better. Please like this and tell me how great of a person I am. And I'll admit, I even fall victim to this sometimes, logging in just to see how many likes I got, to see how many people agreed with me in the comments section. And cult leaders tend to do that. They tend to say, hey, this is the purpose. This is the meaning of life. This is why you were put here. And the love bombing, the constantly telling people, oh, you're great, you're better than other people, you found your way to the true religion or the true whatever. So I think that there's that, the charismatic leader plus the charismatic leader that gives you a sense of purpose and validation. I wanted to talk about some of the other things, though, because Landon does some of these things so well, and I don't think it's just accidental or coincidental that he does them. Having secret words or like an in-group language. I remember when I first joined his Sales Guerrilla thing, and there was like guerrilla hashtags where you started like a kind of like a nom de guerre, like your own gang name for joining. There was things like banana cream pie. And there was all these other things that when you first join the group, you're like, what are these people talking about? But then as you stick with the group a little bit, you're like, oh, okay, so this means this. And even things like ideal client avatar. Okay, ICA means this. And this is the broader concept behind this. But you don't get it right away. And as you're slowly picking up these things, you're like, oh, I get it. Now I feel even more invested in this community because now I know some of their secret words and I feel like I'm climbing this ladder of knowing more and more about this group. And as that happens, as each time I get one of these coded words that I didn't know before, each time that happens, I feel like more a part of this community, more a part of, oh, now I can use this word. So it's a part of my identity now. And I know that cults do this as well. So Landon, I wanted to kind of turn it over to you, and I'm assuming it wasn't just a coincidence that you built that into not just Sales Guerrilla. I see you also doing this with Dig, and I wanted to get your insight on community building and maybe the less nefarious part of helping people identify as part of the group.
Yep. To start at the very core of it. Regardless of which endeavor I'm using this for, my intent is I'm trying to help people have enough initial information to be able to determine if this is for them or not because of this. I'm only really interested in connecting with people that I can relate to. I'm not looking to connect with people that are yes men. I'm not looking to connect with people that just share my opinions. I'm looking to connect with people that can relate to me at a human level, like beyond whatever the topic is, getting clients or making money or dealing with your inner self or whatever it is. I'm looking to be able to relate with people. How do we do that? This is basic sales training stuff. How do you build rapport with somebody? There's a natural way to do it and a manufactured way to do it. And if you go about it naturally, first, you have to be okay with who you are and what you're about. I'm a redneck from Colorado, right? I happen to be a little bit educated and I'm a little smarter than the average bear, but I'm who I am. Long hair, giant beard. I listen to heavy metal and I cuss like a sailor. If that's not for you, go the fuck away. And I want to get that out initially, right? One of the ways that I do that is I also kind of think I'm funny. Right? So my sarcastic wit, the humor that I've got. So if somebody was offended by that, I didn't want them in my world, right? So I'm gonna hit them with some of that language early on. And if they're like, this is childish, cool, go away. This is offensive, cool, go away. So I use it initially for that purpose. The second piece of it, though, is our words have power. And if you're not willing to take the time to understand the language so that you can utilize it and communicate with other people, this isn't for you. And that's a me thing, right? People who are into Nike, people who are into Audi, people who are into Kawasaki, those cultures all have their own language. They do that so people can go, one of us, I'm like these people. People like us do things like this, right? This is where we start crossing the line between what's a cult and what's the culture, right? But formulating an inner circle language like that does a handful of things. And for me, the first and I would say most important is it's a barrier to entry. If you think this is stupid, fantastic, go away. If you think this is offensive, awesome. This isn't for you.
There's a payoff for people involved when it comes to a kind of meaning making too. It's almost like some of the satisfaction that we get from like figuring things out in English, where like we learn a new word and then we start to not only hear that word more often once we know it, but it also has this reward of making something explicit, right? We have made meaning. So when you go into something new and you want to be involved and you realize that there's like an in-group language or secret words that you don't know, to start to learn those words, I think is incredibly satisfying, even if they're meaningless. You know, I rarely talk about this on my podcast, but I do this other show for fun as a hobby. It's a comedy show. The show has its own language. It has its own culture. It has its own folklore. It has its own characters, right? And this is, so it has this whole universe that's been created around it. And I've been fortunate enough to just be a part of doing that with a group of other guys. But I think that a lot of the listeners get a kind of satisfaction in being able to evoke something from this language that we've created into the conversation that we would have. Like if we're live streaming and we're doing a chat and somebody can say, and nobody knows what is who's listening to us, and neither of you guys know either, but everybody listening there knows what it is. And it also, it brings people closer together. We speak the same language. Just like if you scale that to an entire culture, why do people feel connected in higher levels of trust with people like them, right? I know that's kind of a controversial thing to say when you're talking like culturally or nationally, but it's true. It's just like that kind of homogeneity brings a sense of belonging and brings a higher trust. And the same is true in these created groups that have this, you know, whether it's like a kind of cult appeal or organically created internal culture. It's not like in corporations where, you know, the people at the top say, this is the culture we're going to disseminate to everybody through these awkward rituals. But something happens organically, it happens improvisationally, like in this comedy show example, and people go, we really like that, do more of that. Make that part of the language, make that part of the culture. And that's probably like in Landon's experience too. Like you say a thing kind of off the cuff, it resonates with people, it's well received, they think it's funny, they want to hear it again, it becomes part of the vernacular. So, I mean, again, it's a double-edged sword because like I always say, our thoughts become our words, but our words become our thoughts. So if people are given words to use, the British Empire was actually very, very good at this all over the world, was teaching people, especially in the United States, a kind of language of empire, a language that would almost take them away from this idea of, you know, we're our own thing in America. We left Britain. It, you know, this partnership across the sea, all of these terms that were made throughout the 20th century, especially when the British needed to use the United States in World War I and World War II, a language came into this country very much through media and academia to train Americans back into this kind of British alliance, or almost in some cases like servitude to the idea of empire. And you see how that actually played out in the 20th century in the United States as the United States became an empire. So there is a top-down way where, especially if it can be, you know, forced into people's heads through something like the school system or a corporate media, it's, I mean, look at what we've watched in the last year, right? Like how much language has been used to manipulate people's thinking. And then people start using these words like quarantine, lockdown, these inevitabilities. These things that was all put into people's heads, right? That didn't come from the bottom up. I think that came from the top down. But I think it's much healthier when those things kind of emerge organically, you know, in conversation, or like I said, improvisationally through dialogue. And then because they resonate with people in the group and they connect people in the group, they kind of become part of, you know, the permanent record or a way of communicating.
I think Landon hit on something when he was talking about the power that words have. And a lot of times we use words without even realizing what we're actually saying. I think the other thing that, as far as like while we're on the topic of words and secret words and stuff like that, I know like inside of Freemasonry, there's a lot of words and phrases that like standing on your square, or will no one help the widow's son, where if you use them in common vernacular, they'll just go right over people's heads. People won't even realize what you're saying. But if you're part of that group, then you're like, oh, I get you. You're one of us. Having that sense of camaraderie, but also that sense of elitism. Like we're part of this inside of like motorcycle culture. There's the Harley guys, and then there's the Kawasaki guys. And when they're all hanging out, they're all hanging out. But like when the one says one, when the one says something that only the other Kawasaki guy is going to understand, or the other Harley guy is going to understand, they're going to know. And they're going to be like, oh, so we're part of this extra elite group inside of this group. So having those words where it's kind of like a wink and a nod. And I think even wink and a nod is one of those words where certain people get it and certain people don't. And it just flies over the heads of most people. But if you're part of the group and you know those insider words, you get a feeling of like superiority, that you've got the secret knowledge that other people don't have. And building that in, consciously saying, okay, we're going to have some things that allow people that ride Kawasaki's, or maybe the Kawasaki people create it for themselves. But when it comes to like Colts, I think there is a lot of, okay, maybe it's conscious, maybe it's not conscious, but it's there. It's, these are the things that allow our people to have a sense of superiority over the people who aren't our people. I'm going to ask this. I'm going to put this out there. A lot of people who would be great at building a culture or leading a bunch of people who have these skills, who have the ability to help so many people, but they've got this, if I make one mistake, everybody's going to know I'm a fraud. If I get up there and I screw it up, how could I ever recover from that? And I see that plague a lot of people, but the one thing that I always think about is like, the people that get up on CNN and predict what is going to happen with the stock market next week. And 9 times out of 10, they're wrong, but their fans only remember the 1 time out of 10 that they were right. Same thing with people like Alex Jones, spouts off 1,000 different conspiracy theories, happens to be right about the chemicals turning the frogs gay. And that's the one people are like, well, but he was right about the chemicals turning the frogs gay. So a lot of people are worried that if I look like an idiot, I'm going to lose my whole following and everybody's going to hate me. Landon, you've always been the one that's like, as long as I've known you, you just kind of like let it all hang out. And you're like, hey, if I make a fool of myself, oh, well, you can keep sticking around if you enjoy what I'm doing. But your thoughts on people that have something to offer, but are afraid that they're going to look like an idiot. Am I right in that? Or do you have any other insight to that?
Well, first, I think there's 7.8 billion different ways to do, be, and see things, right? There's a lot of people that are wrapped up in, if they're wrong and somebody finds out, what does that mean about them, right? They've got a reputation to uphold. They've got an identity to support. And some people just cannot allow themselves to be wrong for many different reasons, right? Closed mindset versus the open mindset. There's a lot of different reasons for it. By and large, the people who could do it, who just don't have the gall to get on stage and do it, is a fear of what happens if I fuck up. What underlies that, though, is generally people make a claim, right? And so then everything they do has to be about making a claim. And this is one of the things about cults that is different about culture. Cults make a claim. It's like a promise, right? In sales and marketing, they make a promise. And so everything else they do has to uphold that. Effectively, it may be a truth, but it can also, by the same token, be a lie, depending on your perspective. So if you tell one lie, everything else you tell has to support that lie. And most people aren't conscious about the thinking through this process. There's just some kind of fear of fucking up on stage, right? We've all done it. We've all put our foot in our mouth. We've all made a mistake. We've all looked like a fool, and that sucks. And also what a lot of people assume is that if they're the one that's leading the charge or they're leading the group or whatever, that they have to know everything and they have to be perfect. Right. And so you add those few things together and pretty soon that's enough fear to avoid doing the thing. Those of us that get around that, who are generally pretty accurate with, you know, doing our thing, recognize that it's not about you, what I think of myself. Like, my whole reason for wanting to connect with people that I relate with is the people that I relate with are down to earth and they're, you know, realistic, and they understand that humans are prone to make mistakes. So catch me in one. Cool. And when you do, guess what? It doesn't mean anything about me. I'm not hurt. I'm not broken. I'm not scared. Right. Which allows me to kind of fly by the seat of my pants and say what I'm going to say, because if I say something stupid or wrong or inappropriate, cool. I learn, right? It doesn't scare me from getting up and doing it again. And I think a lot of people don't have that. I would never get up on stage and sing. I can't sing. I fucking sing around my house all day long. There's other people here. I'm sure the neighbors can hear it, right? What's the difference between that and getting up on stage in front of 50,000 people? I'm not good enough, right? One form or another, that thought takes root and keeps us from doing things.
Yeah, I've been in your world for years now, and I feel like there's been certain things where I've just looked at you and I'm just like, man, how does Landon have the courage to do that and just be himself about it? Because, and I don't want to make like a blanket statement, but inside of sales and marketing and this whole atmosphere that me and you are in, there's so many people that are just completely fraudulent, and maybe they're successful, but they're not. We talk about authenticity and we talk about these things, but they're not brave enough to be who they really are. And you were always like the, hey, I've got long hair and I've got a giant beard and I wear a Tool t-shirt. I'm not wearing a 3-piece suit, but I can teach you the same stuff all the 3-piece suit people can. But the thing about it was that was like the thing that made me be like, okay, this is the guy that I want to learn from. This is the guy that I want to be a part of his world. This is the guy whose cult I want to join. Not that long hair and a beard make you look like a cult leader or anything, but it was one of those things where it was like, so many people are, even the like very skilled people are afraid to just be like, hey, this is who I am. And if you don't accept me, that's cool. And I think that's the one thing that's different about it is a lot of times when it comes to cults, it's if you're different at all, you can't be part of this. If you even think differently, if you dare to question the established worldview, you're not allowed to be a part of our community. And your being part of your world, it was always different. It was always like, hey, take it or leave it. This is what works for me. It might not work for you, but at least try it on for size.
If it fits, take it. If it doesn't, leave it. I love some of you. I like most of you. There's a few of you I can't stand. Right. Like if you look at it at a on paper surface level, it is exactly the same thing. My stance is if you don't have the ability to think for yourself, then you can't be here. Right. That's just another way of saying you have to do it like this. So it's the same mechanism, but for a different end. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, Brett, is there a way that we can re-segue back to your original question that I rudely interrupted?
Well, belonging has this message of superiority, like as far as compared to people who don't belong inside the organization, in the most unhealthy situations, there is also a repeated reminder of the follower's inferiority to the leader. The identity doesn't come from the things that I mentioned in culture, right? Like if we just want to use like work ways, folk ways, food ways, how cultures, like large scale cultures are built. And, you know, other like media cultures can be built in the ways I describe, kind of from the ground up, kind of by accident, and then things catch on, people involved like this thing, do more of that thing. But in a cult, the identity comes from the leader, right? So people, I think, who get wrapped up in these situations wind up facing this threat of losing their own identity, right? If they question the leader, right? Because their identity is the cult's identity and the cult's identity is the leader's identity. But what I think I was kind of driving at was, is there a healthy way to, I guess, implicitly remind people involved in your world that you're the leader? Right? Because it is, as you build a community, you are going to have personality conflicts. And as you, like we both have, or we've all been involved in something where we encourage people to think for themselves and ask questions. I think being involved or being at the head of anything else would be very gross. Right? Like that would be like having people hang on your every word and worship you. That is, very sketchy to me. That's very icky. And I think we both agree, we all agree on that. But is there an authentic way to maintain leadership status?
So the way I approach that is by being in alignment with what my people are trying to accomplish. Meaning this, here's the thing that I'm interested in. Here's the thing that I'm working on. If that's the thing that you're also interested in working on and what you're trying to accomplish through working through that and understanding it, we can do that together. Well, if it's a thing that I'm interested in and it's a thing that I'm already working on and I'm in alignment with what my people are trying to accomplish, it's pretty easy to stay a couple of steps ahead of them. Mm-hmm. Right? So the healthy way to do that, and at least the way that I approach it, is there are people that have come through my world and have exceeded me to the point where they need something beyond me as far as guidance or mentorship or coaching or information or tactics or whatever. Cool. Move on. That's not really how cults work, right? Like let's take one of the most atrocious cults in history, Christianity.
Wow.
I'm sure I just offended a couple of people there. But think about exactly what you said. The cult's identity is the leader's identity, and everybody below that's inferior to that. Cool. Old school Christianity, not so much now, but old school Christianity, here's the set of rules that you've got to follow. And oh, by the way, I'm the only one that can get you to God. Like, you've got to go through me to get to God. How inferior does somebody need to feel or be trained to feel that there's an intermediary between them and God? Pretty inferior.
Well, who is that intermediary in that case?
The priest.
Okay.
The what are the other terms for the people that hold that? Pastor?
Minister.
Minister?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, go on down the list. It's the leaders of the church. And everybody below that is seen as inferior to that.
Yeah, it's very easy for a racket to develop around faith, right? Because once, right. You know, I have like changed my position on this a lot over the last decade, and I do see like a lot of redeeming features of religion. And again, it's like anything that's large enough, I mean, we're talking over a billion people, you're going to have all different kinds of people with all different kinds of autonomy, capability, belief in self. And it's also, I've also said too, that the longer a faith exists, the more it's kind of pressed upon by reason. Like, in a lot of cases, like, you know, Christianity's been around for almost 2,000 years, and or maybe, well, in its modern form, it's been around for 1700 years. You know, at this point, they're like, all right, we give up, you know, evolution, fine. They've seeded all of these things just because it's been pressed on and shaped by reality. But you see faiths that are much newer where they are still promoting some pretty wild ideas. I mean, even Islam, you look at the problems in the Muslim world and people go, oh, how uncivilized. Well, that was what was going on in Salem, Massachusetts 300 years ago. And, you know, Islam is, you know, 300 years newer than Christianity. So you can see that the longer a faith exists, the more it winds up just having to submit to reality in a lot of ways. But it doesn't mean that the belonging, the linking of people, the lig in religion, the connecting of people together doesn't have some of its benefits. But it's endlessly exploitable. It's endlessly exploitable. And I think it's getting harder to do that, which is maybe why there is more of a conforming to reality. But I grew up Catholic. I don't want to go on a rant about this, but there's problems. Yeah, there's problems, you know.
Do you feel guilty about it?
No, not anymore. I mean, I was an altar boy, you know? So that's how good I am, right? I'm an altar boy. Oh, wait, that's a choir boy. There's something that's like synonymous with being good. It's choir boy, not altar boy.
The weird thing about that, though, is the dual realities. Because you're part of this group, you're better than other people. But because you're part of this group, you're not good enough. You need me. So that's kind of like the two conflicting worldviews that seem to work hand in hand. You're better than other people, but you're not as good as me. So judge them, but let me judge you. Mm-hmm. Kind of a weird thing that's going on. One other thing too, though, as society, I think America now, we're at the point where there's more atheists than Christians in the country, or it's like creeping up on that area. And I would say, though, especially with like the way politics have gotten recently, a lot of people are still very culty with their politics. They just said, well, we're not going to be a cult of religious beliefs. We're going to be a cult of political beliefs. The contradictions in some of the beliefs, the blatant double standards in some of the it's okay when our team does it, but it's not okay when your team does it. A lot of that stuff that's been going on. It seems like even if you, I would agree with Landon that Christianity was probably one of the biggest cults, but now politics seems to have adopted the cult mentality, the whatever the situation is, like our, when our guy's in charge, even though he's doing the same things that the other guy was doing, he's God's gift to humanity. We were blessed with this leader, even though I don't believe in God or whatever. But when the next guy comes in who's doing the exact same things that you praised your guy for doing, it's the worst thing ever. And he's a total fascist and we're about to have a dictatorial takeover. Politics has become very cult-like. And I know, Landon, you really don't like to even dive into this subject, but me and Brett do. So before I give Brett the chance to respond, I want to know your thoughts on the cult-like behavior of politics recently.
So one thing I'd like to point out and add to the conversation is more often than not, when people get interested in a topic for conversation, it's easy to allow it to become microscopic. If you look throughout history, and I'm not talking about the last 2,000 years, I'm talking about the last 100,000 years of documented history in different cultures like the Chinese culture, the Middle Eastern culture. If you look at how this works, it almost always falls in these four categories and generally in this order. First, it's control by religion, then it's control by monetary, then it's control by political, and then it's control by force. And if you look throughout history, it almost always follows that process. First, we can control people through the religion. And then when that begins to falter, it becomes about the money. When that begins to falter, it becomes about politics. And when that's no longer feasible to control the masses, it's force. And generally, it's force by an external takeover. So in this context, in the conversation that we're having about cult and politics, et cetera, if you go back into Europe 500, 800, 1,000 years ago and see what happened over a period of time, pick any country, do the same thing in Asia or the Middle East, right? We're experiencing our own version of it. Religion's no longer able to hold us, right? To the point where you don't even have to, whatever the Pledge of Allegiance is, right? Like they adjusted the language to that years ago. Money. We all basically really understand that it's fucking make-believe. We can trade currencies that aren't even regulated by the government any longer. So that's not working. What's been the thing the last 20 or 30 years? Politics. What's coming next? Right? So we can stay stuck in the microscopic view of it, the political view, and we can totally go down that road. But what's more important is the bigger aspect that's going on. What is it ultimately? The few at the top controlling the masses. Mm. So let's talk about the politics thing. Why is there basically two parties? Because it's a control thing. So it doesn't matter if you're red or blue, right? Yeah, there's a couple other parties, but if you vote for them, you're taking away a vote for the other person that, you know, like the lesser of two evils that you could vote for. The whole political thing is literally just a game. It doesn't matter who's in office. They're not even the ones that are behind the control of the thing. What is the control of the thing? It's control of the resources. How do we maneuver the resources? So if you want to talk about an actual cult, let's just talk about humanity in general. Hmm. Right? Politically, at a global scale, there really are no politics. Politically, at a local scale, like in your local county or township, politics still exist. But the politics that we're kind of trying to talk about here, this is really just a show to keep the masses of people occupied while the control is still being exerted on the masses. Of course, this is just an opinion. I could be wrong.
Geez, so much stuff comes up for me right there. So I'll try to move through it as swiftly as I can. I mean, first of all, I think 2016 was the first time we saw the emergence of a political figure who's like, this game that you guys are playing, I'm not playing, right? At least that was the presentation. In the end, it looked like he played the game or was shown something that says, look, you're going to play the game. Some kind of arm was twisted or something. But we saw somebody who was so, disrespectful to that system. It just drove people crazy. This is not what you're saying. And that was why all the elites attacked him. I'm talking about Trump. Yeah, I that might be the only time in our lives that we see something like that. Everybody else is like, look, whatever, this is how the power structure works. We're all subservient to it. And this is the game that you have to play if you want a piece of that power. He got it seemingly some other way, which is why I think that all of the elites were driven so crazy by him, because it's like you're breaking the rules. You know, that progression that you laid out, Landon, of first it's religion, then it's money, then it's politics, and then it's force. The first video that I ever made for YouTube like 12 years ago was called I Could Just Murder You. It kind of goes through maybe like a few thousand year history of human interactions on Earth. And in the beginning, it's like, look, I could just murder you. I could just crush your head with this rock or stab you with this spear or throw you off this cliff. And eventually we were civilized to the point where people said, guess what, everybody, gather around me. I'm God. Maybe you'll spend your whole life building my burial site, but it'll be worth it because I'm God. And the way the video kind of progresses is like this, the people in power having this imaginary conversation with a rational and curious person, and then having to adjust their story, their justification for power throughout the way. So it's like, all right, I'm God, so you better do what I say. All right, fine, I'm not God, but I talk to God, or I know people who talk to God or can interpret the will of God, and I rule at God's behest. And then like that gets really worn out and people's heads get cut off and they say, oh, you know what? We were wrong. We do not the will of God. We do the will of you, the people. We do your will. And so you see this like backpedaling and goalposts moving. And then it seemed like in the last decade, it's just like, you know what? We could just murder you. Obama has a kill list. We have militarized police in the United States. Like, we could just murder you if we want. So it was almost like my thinking was we had already gotten to the force. And you know, there's a lot of force throughout the whole history of politics and government. Obviously, that's what props it up. But I don't know. I just thought that was interesting that you laid out a progression like that. I never thought about it quite that way, but in a similar way. So I don't know. I don't want to go off the rails here talking about politics for an hour. So Nathan, if there's anything else you want to say about it, or Landon, you want to follow up, go ahead. But I'm just going to clam up.
Landon, go ahead, because it looks like you got something to say.
What better time to offer up a clown like Trump, regardless of what you think about him?
Totally agree.
What better time to offer him up than when the entire country is fucking fed up with politics? You got to maintain some semblance of the traditional control mechanism, because you're not ready to roll out whatever's coming next. Nobody wanted Clinton, right? There wasn't really anybody else that could stand on stage and get as much attention as Trump. And still, he's not the guy calling the shots.
Right.
Like, what better time in history in the last 50 years to offer up somebody like him and have the country go, yep, we're going to make change now.
Yeah.
Really? How'd that work out? Like, it's the same.
Well, you saying like offer him up, though, it makes me so conspiratorial. When he got elected, I was walking down the street the next day and I said, nope, this isn't real. He was installed for some kind of purpose. And then I go, yeah, that's crazy, Brett. You don't know anything. You're just trying to, you know, maintain your own belief system by, you know, not recognizing that this actually could have been a decision made by people, always thinking like elections were illegitimate or whatever. Then 4 years later, I'm looking back at it. I'm going, yeah, that does seem like it was a kind of a plot. Right. Because everything, it's like you're against anything we're doing. You're one of these people. You're one of these problematic, racist, insurrectionists. So I don't know. Offered up is it's interesting. I might just edit that out of the show, and no. I'm going to try to not keep going. But
no, hold on.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add, I think as far as like cult building, Trump.
Oh, what a great example. Yeah.
Yeah. He was a master at it. I mean, here's the cult garb that we wear. You've got to get the red hat with the white letters to show that you're part of the cult. We've got our own three syllable catchphrases. Three syllables are very important to certain rhetoric. We got the drain the swamp. We got the lock her up.
Build a wall.
Build a wall. We've got multiple. We got three syllable catchphrases right there. So 33. So there was a lot for me to be like, just watching it and be like, yeah, this is also very culty. And I have a lot of conservative friends and a lot of liberal friends. And it's funny because the one group is always accusing the other group of being cult members. And that's kind of why I wanted to bring it up. Cause me sitting in the middle, I'm always like, yes, you're both right. Mm-hmm. One thing that you did mention, I want to move on from this, but I want to talk about doomsday cults, the mentality that attracts people to doomsday cults. And I remember when I was a kid living in California, there was this on Hollywood Boulevard, there was this cult Christian organization that always said the end of the world is going to happen in 1983. And they always would stand out on the corner, the intersection, with their big signs warning people that the end of the world was happening. And then it didn't happen. And I was like, okay, finally, that cult's going to go away. But they just moved the goalpost. And they said, actually, the end of the world is going to happen in 1987. And then it didn't happen in 1980. Actually, we got our numbers wrong, but we were right with the basic concept. It's going to be 1989. And in April of 1989, to be specific. I know that this is such a touchy topic, but I feel like nowadays I've watched the same thing happen with the whole Corona thing. Everybody, 2 million dead by the end of October. Oh, actually 2 million dead by December. Oh, actually this and this, 6 feet distance. Oh, actually 3 feet is okay. Oh, actually this. And I get that, like, as new studies come out and we have to adjust what we believe, but I know a lot of people that just blindly believe whatever the cult leader tells them to say. And then this week they're saying this, and next week it's a different doomsday scenario. And it doesn't even bother them that for the last 8 months they've been saying the world is going to end in 1983. And now Fauci comes out, or now Bill Gates comes out and says, actually 1987, you're good until 1987. And everybody says, we're going to be good until 1987. I always thought, like, joining a cult would be about making a better life, but a lot of cult mentality is just obsession with doom. And when the doom doesn't happen, they find another thing to be scared about and terrified, another end of the world, apocalyptic scenario. And I would say that, again, going back to politics, it's the world is going to end because of global warming. The world is going to end because Mexicans are going to come to take all our jobs and destroy the economy. There's always like the world is going to end. Let's be afraid and let's trauma bond over how horrible things are. And maybe, I don't know, it's a weird thing to unpack, but these people that constantly want to be afraid, and when it's determined that they were not justified in their fear, they just find another reason to be afraid. They kick the can of fear down the road, and now it's, oh, actually, we see this with, if we don't change things by 3 years, the world's going to end in 10 years. Oh, and then we hit the three-year mark. Actually, sea levels are going to rise by this year. And it's always just this refusal to let go of the fear. And it seems to be something that's exploited both in marketing. If you buy this, your life will be good and you'll be happy. And then they are for a second, and then they need something else to buy to be happy. If you don't buy this, people are going to make fun of you. If you don't buy this diamond ring, she's not going to love you. If you don't buy this jacket, the kids aren't going to accept you. This constant need of people to hold on to this negativity, to this fear, to this doomsday mentality. And when they're proven wrong, they just look for another reason to justify, dig their heels in deeper. I kind of want to get both of you guys' take on why we're so attracted to these negative doomsday, worst possible scenarios, and how that is both used by marketing and cult leaders and politicians, and I'll just stop right there and hand it over to whoever wants to jump in.
Can I go real quick? I have a short answer. Because I think they've already bought into the cult's promise of salvation, right? And that's true in all of these cases, right? So you could say that they're focused on the doom, but I think that doom always comes at least embedded with some promise of salvation, right? So when you even in like marketing examples, she's not going to love you, doom, if you don't get the diamond ring, salvation. You're not going to get laid if you don't, that's all implicit in a lot of advertising today. If you don't do this thing, you're not going to be respected. But this thing is the salvation. It is the sex. It is the respect. And I think that a lot of like the doomsday cults, first of all, interestingly enough, it's based on Christian biblical prophecy. The one in Japan that did the subway bombing, I think it was in the 90s, that was called Om Shinrikyo. They had to adjust their predictions a couple of times, but one of the things, and eventually people did start to ask questions and get disillusioned with what was going on, but what the day-to-day activities were, even as it went, you know, further and further away from maybe what was initially set out as like, here's what's going to happen, here's what we're preparing for, and then that didn't happen, and they had to kind of change their tune a little bit. They had people on a really rigid program of these are the activities that bring about salvation. And I think that might be how people implicitly accept all of these things. You could see a lot of this in the sort of COVID cult that developed around the last year, right? The salvation is science, right? So we need to keep reminding people about the doom because our religion is science. Our religion is... How creepy is this thing right now going on around this vaccine? I've never considered myself an anti-vaxxer, and I always thought that was like an easy way to lose people, and you really, really need to know what you're talking about. But when I see celebrities saying, look at what I'm doing, you know me, I'm famous, look at me do this thing, and you should do this thing too, that makes me very skeptical about doing that thing. If some like thoughtless billboard of a human being is just promoting this thing. I put a video of these YouTube guys called The Try Guys, and it's four guys who have Anthony Fauci on their show to say, we're here to debunk every conspiracy. And then they ask him, like in these silly, condescending voices, all of the conspiracy theories around the vaccine. And he just says, no, that's not true. And they're like, well, that settles it. I mean, it's creepy. And that's not like coming from an anti-vax perspective. It's coming from a perspective of like, how are other people not realizing how little thought is going into this? And it is this kind of like cult of scientism. That's what we're seeing. Scientism and safetyism really kind of like took up, because that is the salvation. We live in the century of the safe. That was the name of my last show. This is a century that so far has been shaped by, ironically, a conservative response or a Republican response to the events of 9/11, right? Safety and security have set the tone for the first two decades of this century. And 2020, that just all escalated sharply. Sorry, Landon, I said that was a short answer. Salvation. They've already been promised salvation. So it doesn't matter what they have to adjust or what they have to overlook as far as mistakes are concerned. They are married to the salvation that the cult or the product or the whatever is being promised to them. So they keep pushing forward. I think their future and their identity is really wrapped up in that.
To answer your question, Nathan, I think it's because we are biologically wired that there's a tiger in the bush. Mm. Biologically wired for our survival to be alert to things that are dangerous. And because we've made our society so safe over the last couple of hundred years, there's really no tiger in the bush. But that mechanism of becoming alerted is so, it's such a hair trigger that it's way easier to use that than if you eat right and don't smoke and work out, you could live to 120. Like the pull to stuff that we want, it's not near as effective as the push to get away from stuff that we're afraid of. Right?
Yeah.
And then you make 7 billion of us on a planet and technology moves as fast as it does. And somebody came out and lied about something 50 years ago and got away with it. later on it was found out that they lied to us, right? Pretty soon we're in this conundrum of there's so much information, the world's moving so fast, and we don't even know who to listen to. But I'm scared because there's that tiger in the bush and that tiger in the bush and that tiger in the bush and that tiger in the bush. Somebody has to know better than me. And if I can just find who they are and then listen to what they're saying, then I'll be safe. Right? So safety, salvation.
Man.
Same idea. Humans are very easily scared. This whole culture that we've got, cancel culture, fucking all, everybody gets a trophy culture, right? You can't say shit that's offensive culture. Like, we've crafted our own demise. It may come in the form of a virus or another country, you know, approaching our borders. Likely it will be because we've turned ourselves into such pussies that we can't cope with everyday experience.
Matthew Crawford, so in the book we just did the show on, the book was called Why We Drive, and it's criticizing and warning people about automation, it primarily in this case in the form of self-driving cars, and talking about the freedom of mobility and contrasting it with the physical and the psychological confinement that a lot of people feel in the world today. And he says, as we become, he calls it safetyism, as this becomes more of, you know, the motivating force, certainly in American society, certainly in the Western world, because it's not like Canada or Great Britain's any better with any of this stuff, especially around COVID. But behaviors that used to be normal, if they're even slightly dangerous, will be seen as more irresponsible and aberrant in this increasing like deference to safety and caution and security and those kinds of things. So I think, you know, Landon and I are providing really similar answers, that it's absolutely right. It's capitalizing on the tiger in the bush impulse, right? The tiger in the bush biology that we have. But wait, you don't have to be eaten by that tiger or that tiger, or, you know, all of those tigers that are out there and all of the bushes that surround you, because there's this promise of salvation. There was no promise of salvation. When that impulse was installed into us historically, there was no salvation. The salvation was, at some point the tiger's eating you and you just pass out and that's the best you can do. There's no heaven. There's nothing, right? There's no statue. You eventually lose consciousness because you're bleeding out and that's the end of that. Now there's all kinds of, so religion comes, it's this promise of salvation. There's all kinds of ways to get it politically. There's all kinds of ways to get it socially. There's all kinds of ways to get it through products and belonging in communities. So there's promises of salvation everywhere today.
So as we wrap up, I want to give a couple examples of businesses that I think do the cult thing very well. And then I want to talk to Landon about something that he taught me. But as far as brands that have built like a cult-like following, I think the first one that I ever realized, oh, these guys just built a cult, was the Kiss Army when we were kids. I was just like, wow, like this is literally a cult for profit. They've built a business where they get to do what they love because they have this rabid fan base who identifies with what they're all about. I haven't seen very many other bands that have been able to do it as well as the Kiss Army. Do you guys have any, does anything come to you guys' mind for bands that have done as good a job as building a cult or a culture around their brand?
ICP.
Oh yeah. ICP is almost, they just basically copied the Kiss Army though.
So the Kiss Army was actually a marketing ploy. Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons are both quite educated when it comes to marketing and making sales, but their management team was excellent at it. So Led Zeppelin built theirs organically. Pink Floyd built theirs organically. The Who, the Beatles, those were all organic. And then the management staff of the record labels that they were under leveraged that. Kiss was kind of started with the whole idea of this is the formula on how to do it, and we're just going to go ahead and call it the Kiss Army, right? But Tool, Metallica, AC/DC, Motley Crue, like go on down the list, they all have their own cult following, right? Crew heads, Motley Crue, right? Tool, like the people that are in that crew, they all know it, right? From the outside, though, KISS did an excellent job doing it because they gave them a, oh, you're part of the army now.
The other one that immediately comes to mind for me, not as far as music goes, but Apple. I think Apple has done, especially back in the day when they had the old like 1984 commercials where buying Apple meant you were smashing the hierarchy that was dominating electronics at the time. Now Apple has become what they were fighting against. But you see when a new Apple product comes out, people will line up around the block and sleep and camp out to buy the new iPhone.
Even if they just bought one 18 months ago. Sorry. Apple users are welcome. Apple users are welcome. Welcome to the show.
But it's weird that like Apple versus Android. Android makes a lot of sales, but they don't have that same cult fever around them that Apple does.
Yeah, but boy, we sure have the same kind of opinions. They're just of different opinions.
True that.
Right? So in 84, Apple was all about think different. The only reason that I'm an Android and PC guy is because I'm not going to be told how to think. Right? Like, same idea. Inside the clan, inside the crew, inside the cult, like whatever, there's a reason for it. I don't want to be like that.
Right. Harley Davidson, I think maybe it's waning a little bit, but I remember as a kid, Harley Davidson had the biggest cult following. Like if you had a motorcycle and it wasn't a Harley, it was hard to even be taken seriously back in the day. But then they started letting like retiree doctors be their main target market. And I think they lost that edge, that cult that was built around their brand.
It's the Rebels.
Yeah, there you go. And then Starbucks is another one that I think does a great job of cult building around their brand. I am not a big fan of Starbucks as far like I do drink chai teas pretty frequently, but Starbucks is my least favorite place to get one. But a lot of people will pay three times as much just to buy Starbucks just because it's Starbucks. And I haven't been able to figure it out.
I was going to ask you about that. Anytime there's the proposal in my life, let's get a coffee, not at home, I say, we have to find a Starbucks. So I get in the car, I'm driving, whoever I'm with, I'm like, boy, I'm so excited that soon I'm going to be drinking Starbucks coffee. Ah, I can't wait for Starbucks. I walk into the place, I stand there for a minute, I go, Jesus, I fucking hate this place. I hate all these people. I hate the way this, I hate all their bullshit. Then I get the coffee and I walk out and I go, I'm so glad I have this coffee. It's delicious. This is the best coffee. I'm so glad I came to Starbucks. So yeah, Nathan, I'm mystified. Just good coffee, maybe? That seems to be what my experience is.
It's actually programming. And Nathan, you should know more about this than I do. It's actually programming with the symbols and the language that they use and how they entrain the people that they want drinking their coffee. What do you got to do when you have a massive cookie cutter operation? Like they're McDonald's. Like, what do you got to do to accomplish that? It's literally about programming. This is why you're okay having the cookie cutter option, because it's always just this good.
I don't know. The language, I go in there and I go, you know what, fuckers? I'm not saying grande. I don't say that. I say the large one. That's what I say. I won't even use their words.
They make it okay for you to not use their language, but you said their business name 9 times in that example that you used.
What, Starbucks?
9 times. Okay. Now, what's interesting about that is Starbucks. Do you know what that comes from? Do you know where the name Starbucks comes from? Do you understand what it means?
No. No, I have no idea.
Do you think anybody does?
No.
Why don't we say, I want Folgers. I want Folgers. God, I need a Folgers. We don't say that. But around Starbucks, we do. Nathan couldn't even come up with the name of the drink he gets. Right? But every fall, you can find it all over social media and the internet. White girls are getting smashed about their fucking pumpkin spice. Why is that?
I don't know. But I do know that they also, I think, that the logo that they have does have some historic occult reference to it as well.
programmed by symbols.
There,
symbols and language.
There you go. Okay, so the last thing that I wanted to, man, first of all, Landon, thank you for spending these 2 hours with us. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
And Brett, you as well.
My pleasure.
The last thing that I wanted to talk about as far as cults and businesses and culture, something that I saw on an old Dan Kennedy tape. This is like a tape that I got back in the 90s or early 2000s of Dan Kennedy. And he was talking about having a ladder for people to climb. And one of the examples was inside of Freemasonry, you're an entered apprentice, and then you're whatever the next level is, and then you're a master mason. And I might have messed that up. But he talked about inside of the Boy Scouts. The Boy Scouts have the same thing. You're this type of Boy Scout, and then you work your way up to this type of Boy Scout, and then you work your way up to this type of Boy Scout. And it keeps people excited. It keeps people involved. It keeps people coming back. And in business, one thing, Landon, that you taught me when I was like, well, what do I do next? You were like, well, you already have customers. What do they want next? And it was like such a aha moment for me, but so many people don't have these ladders built in, these progressions for people to go through as they're going deeper and deeper with your business. I feel like you've done a good job of that. And I think that also maybe you probably have some self-criticisms of how you could have done it better or what you would do differently. But I want to get your insights on that, having ladders for your customers, your clients to climb at different levels, and what you think the psychological impacts of that are, both from cults, Boy Scouts, stuff like that. Why is it that that's such an appealing model that we're so attracted to?
Because of how we're biologically wired. Think about how you learned how to walk, right? Did you at 9 or 10 or 11 months old see other people walking and something clicked? Fuck, I can do that too. And you just stood up and started walking? No, you're mimicking the people around you, right? You see somebody sit up and sit down and sit up and sit down and sit up and sit down. It's step by step by step by step. Here's an interesting question for everybody that's listening to this. I want you to think about this. Think about the thing you're trying to accomplish. Think about the thing that in life, like the big main thing you're trying to accomplish for yourself. Is it something super simple, like a one-step thing? Or is it something that like, it's going to take some work. It's going to take some knowledge and some learning and some practice. Anything worthwhile, meaning anything somebody will pay for, is a big want. And if they're going to be doing the doing to accomplish that want, they know internally, whether they've admitted it to themselves or not, that this is a many-step process. Okay, so back to the cult thing. Here's the thing you want. Here's the thing you're trying to accomplish. This is big. It's going to take you a while to get there. The reason for that is because it's not one-step thing. There's many steps on the way there. Boy Scouts, perfect example. Cub Scouts, what do they teach you in Cub Scouts? And I think there's one even before Cub Scouts, right? What do they teach you? It's all super basic shit on how to maneuver your body and hand-eye coordination stuff. You don't get to like shooting bows and arrows and shit until you're in junior high and high school. Why don't they just give a five-year-old a bow and arrow and say, here you go, have fun.
Even school.
Because they
follow this.
Right. Yeah. If there's something big enough to actually put time and effort into accomplishing, there's many steps to it. And what many people, martial arts is the perfect example, right? You want to become a ninth degree black belt in jujitsu? It ain't happening this next weekend if you've never been to a dojo. We intrinsically understand this. Now, for the marketing and the cult building and the culture building piece of it, you got to go from you're in and now you're an initiate to a master. And that's not one step. There's many steps to it, right? And so a good marketer understands this. Here's the big thing you want. Now I've got to sell you on here's all the steps it takes to get there. But here's the things that you'll attain and achieve at every step, which makes it worthwhile to put the time and effort into getting that because I want that big thing really, really bad. And I get all these other things. Oh my God. Right? Now it's a step-by-step process. That makes sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. It's just, it's one of those things that we see everywhere. And the examples we just gave were like five very common examples. We see them everywhere, but until you actually stop and think about why is it structured? What is the relation that it has with our own psyche? Why is this something that is so attractive to us? And I know so many people that have one offer in their business and they're like, okay, I tapped out my market. What do I do next? And I ran into that problem. And you're like, well, you didn't tap out your market. You just tapped out your offer.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. If you want to fly a helicopter, it's not going to happen in a week. Like, this is the thing with everything that's worthwhile doing. Building a business, getting married and having kids, like everything. Changing the world, right? Leading the herd away from the cliff. Like, there's many steps to it, right? Like, it is what it is. I love making you laugh, Nathan. That's my favorite thing.
That's an inside joke. That's one of the things that me and Landon butt heads about sometimes because I'm very stubborn. Brett, did you have any closing thoughts? And then I want to definitely give Landon the ability to plug anything that he wants to let the listeners know about.
No, I just think it's we're all in a place where we're kind of adjusting our offers right now. So I talked pretty extensively in my last show, Nathan, about what we're working on building. And that's really an adjustment of both of our offers, right? Like, our audiences want these new things. They want to go to this next step, but it's going to be a select group of people who want that, you know? So we're in the process of building that and trying to find out, you know, who those people are. And that's just a really exciting thing. And I know Landon's in a similar place.
Yeah. And Landon recently did a major pivot in what he was doing and has created something that's been, I'm just going to say, life-changing for me to be a part of. And I would feel like I was doing the audience a disservice if I didn't give Landon the ability to plug Dig and let people know what Dig is, because like I said, that's a big part of why I wanted to have you come on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate the opportunity. The short answer is it's free. It's my Facebook group. I'm still formulating the offer that I'm going to make to the public, meaning anybody that's not already in it. For 30 years or so, I was looking for the answers, and I kept finding myself looking to other people for the answers, finding mentors, finding coaches, looking for an older brother, right? Looking for guidance. And one day it occurred to me that while other people, some of them have found their answers, sometimes they fit and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they fit kind of, and sometimes they really don't fit. Even though the outcomes they're getting because of the answers they found seem like the same shit that I want. And what occurred to me was that ultimately I'm looking for my own answers, and identifying resources and people as points of reference to kind of get my bearings so I can see how they've got their own answers and apply some of that to my own experience. The way that I see it is, dude, it's a game. It's an inner game, one we play between ourselves and our identity. And so what I'm most interested in currently is exploring this idea between what am I really, source or whatever you want to call it, and why am I wielding this ego or this identity, and how do I integrate those two and get them to play together? And what I've found, at least for myself, is the more I can understand why my identity has been formed the way it has, the easier it is to fix, heal, and adjust how I see myself. The more I do that, the more in alignment I feel with what I call source or higher consciousness, or like the truth of me, the easier my life gets. And the more of the shit that I want in life just seems to happen on its own. So that's kind of the thing that I'm doing now. And over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be clarifying how I do that in my Facebook group, which is Dude, It's a Game on Facebook. So there's my thing. If you're interested in shit like that, come check it out.
I would definitely recommend checking out Landon Porter's thing. It's amazing.
Nice.
Awesome.
All right, Landon, thank you so much, man. I appreciate it. Brett, thank you for entertaining this for your podcast. And if listeners are not familiar with your podcast, maybe I might release this to my audience as well.
Yeah. Hey, you asked for closing words, and I could probably be more inspirational than I was. Charles Manson convinced people to kill people by claiming the Beatles were embedding a call for a race war into their music in the White Album. And you can too. Я счастлив, как никогда, да.